you figure it out for yourself. I've been to 2 meetings in 2 areas, and she followed me to give me the word. Part of my rationalization. So I just waited, and sure enough, Eddie came home one day, and he said to me, "Winnie, I think you could use a game of golf." And I looked him right in the eye. I said, "I'd rather not." He said, "What the hell do you mean you'd rather not?" And I said, "I don't know. That's all Maxine ever tells Paul." But it worked, you see. And that was the beginning of my realizing that one of my defects of character was the fact that I always had to explain to people what I meant without knowing what I meant. I used to, you know, in my explanation, I used to get so carried away that sometimes I'd change my mind right in the middle, you know, because it just worked out that way. And I have eliminated a lot of misery and unhappiness in my life by not having to explain anything to anybody. You know, when you have to explain your own existence or why you should be happy, you know. That was another thing that they did to me when I was new in Al-Anon. The first Al-Anon speaker I ever heard was a gal that always started her talk off by saying, "My name is Fran and I love an alcoholic." And I wanted to knock her down, actually, because I figured getting stuck with one was bad enough, but to brag about it was just little more than I could take. And so at the next meeting, they always asked the newcomer or whoever, and I was a perennial newcomer for a long time, but they always asked them, "How did you enjoy the meeting?" And I was very honest, because they had gotten that across to me. I told them very, very sincerely that I really didn't believe the sick one should be allowed to talk. And because of that one honest little statement on my part, those females gave me an assignment. I was supposed to go home, take Eddie's hand, and say, "Eddie, I love you. That's all." I said, "You're kidding. That's what you have to do." And I was so sick, I didn't know you didn't have to do anything, you know. Took me 3 months before I actually did it, and I didn't do it then because I wanted to. I did it because every time I went to that meeting, one of those females would say, "Have you done it yet?" And I didn't know how to sidestep a yes or no answer, see? And I didn't want to lie to them, because I had actually seen people come into that meeting that disappeared. I never saw them again, and I didn't know what happened to them. And I didn't want to take any unnecessary chances, so one night after the light was off, I reached over and I took Eddie's hand and I said, "Eddie, I love you." And he sat right straight up in bed. He said, "What the hell's the matter with you now?" And that isn't one of life's most romantic answers, but I learned something that night that I couldn't have found out any other way. No matter how many times he tells me, no matter how many ways he tries to prove to me how he feels about me, if I'm not in the mood to listen, he's wasting his time. Because I got a button back here, and that little button goes off occasionally and says, "Are you going to let that sucker get away with that after what he did to you in 1943? You know, because I hold a grudge for a long, long time, you know. So there really is no way, unless I can crawl into his head and figure out what's going on, that he can prove to me how he feels about me. But at the very same time, I found out for the first time how I felt about him. I found out that with my father, with my husband, and even today with my son, it's not that I don't love them. It's that I don't like what they're doing. And I have a perfect right to dislike what they're doing. What I don't have a right to do is insist that they do it my way so that I have a comfortable feeling, supposedly, because they are minding me. I have control of them. I have had to learn to take them as they are and to let them be. Just the fact that Eddie got sober didn't solve anything. He still drives me up a wall on a regular basis. But since I found out I'm climbing, it ain't so bad, you know. And I've had people say, "I thought when I came to Al-Anon that my life would straighten out." And I said, "Well, mine never straightened out. Mine goes up and down like an elevator." The only change is that since I've been in Al-Anon, I get to ride in the car instead of getting the shaft. And that's pretty much the way it was. See, I don't drop like I used to, because I can feel it coming. And I can let him do and say whatever it is he wants to do and say, and I don't have to worry about it at all. I have a formula. I never answer a statement. If he says, that moon is sure shining out there tonight, sorry with me, I know it ain't dark, but if he don't know it ain't dark, that's not my problem. See? And it drives him crazy. Because this is one of his little methods for getting me into conversation. See, and usually I end up talking to myself while he goes off and has a good time wherever he's going to go. Because I didn't find out until, oh, maybe 4 or 5 years ago that he talks to himself. And that when I say to him, what did you say? That gets me in trouble. Because then he tells me what he's thinking about. He was mumbling to himself one morning when I went out to get a cup of coffee, and I said to him, oh, did you say something to me? And he says, oh, no, I was just saying the lawn sure needs to be cut. And the kids were still younger then, and so that's all he said. And he went off to the office, and when Butch got up, I said to him, your father mentioned that the lawn ought to be cut. And that's all I said. And then Butch ran into Billy, and he said, Dad said for you to cut the lawn. And I want you to know that before Eddie got home that night, the lawn had been cut 3 times. It looked like it had been plowed, because everybody handed it to everybody else and then didn't trust them to do it, so they did it themselves, you know. And when Eddie came home, he says, what the hell happened to the lawn? And I said, I don't know. Somebody cut it, I guess, you know. And he's never talked about the lawn being cut in, you know, since, because he had to reseed it and everything else, you know. But once I discovered that he talked to himself, it's made my life a lot easier. We made a trip from California to Hot Springs, Arkansas. And I don't think we said 10 words to one another. He talked all the way, but not to each other, you know. He just mumbled. And we just went along, and it was a marvelous trip. I don't know that it'd work a second time, but we ended up in Kansas City, and we were playing golf with a girlfriend of mine, and she and I were riding in one cart, and Eddie was walking. And she said to me, Winnie, Eddie just said something to you. And I said, no, he didn't. And she said, yes, he did. I heard him. And I said, no, you heard him talking, but you did not hear him talking to me. And that was all that was said. And when I got home, there was a letter there from Cecil that said, what do you mean he was talking, but he wasn't talking to you? And so I called her on the phone and told her, and now she's going to Al-Anon too, you know, because she's married to one of those. But anyhow, all of these things are things that turned up in the fourth and the fifth step, you know, being able to become acquainted with myself. That was quite a chore, because I did not turn out to be at all like I thought I was. I didn't turn out to be brilliant. I'm not dumb, but I'm not brilliant, and I always thought I was. I knew a little bit about a lot of things, but I didn't know anything about the most important things that there are in this world today, and that's me. Because I truly believe I am the most important person in my life. And as long as I continue feeling that way, I'm able to do things for other people because I do them because I want to, not because I have to. And that was important for me to learn. It made a whole lot of difference as far as my relationship with my family. As I told you yesterday, or maybe it was this morning, I had to use both the traditions and the steps in order to recover. And I'm still using them. But I always give the first tradition the credit for allowing me to become a member of my own family, because the first tradition says the recovery for the greatest number depends upon unity. And I always had unity and unison confused. I thought that if I said, when dinner is over, we're going to do so-and-so, and nobody objected, that meant they agreed. That's not what it meant. It meant they knew that if they disagreed, we were never going to get through with dinner. That's what it meant, see? And dinner would be over, and they would disappear like they'd never been there. And when it finally got to me, I said to Wilma one day, I said, why is it that they do this to me? After all I've done for them, why do they treat me this way? And she said, let me ask you a question. Have you ever asked them, or have you always told them? She said, go home and look up the word unity. And the definition of the word unity is the ability to disagree agreeably. And I never knew that before. I thought that if you agreed with me, that meant that we had unity. But that's not what it means. And so I had to take the label, mother, off and allow myself to become a member of my own family. And it worked out great. I heard a kid in Alateen one time say, if your kids grow up to be your friend, you must have done something right. And that I took as a little sort of a gimmick to help me get along with my kids, because mine were not perfect kids. You know, I had one daughter. I very rarely mention this because it is not really my story. It's her story. But she had a problem with pills, and I did the same thing that I had done with Eddie. Only I rationalized that it was different. See, I had been in Al-Anon and so forth and so on, and I used to say to Wilma, to release a husband is one thing. He's only a relative by marriage anyhow. But a child, how can I desert this child? Well, I wasn't trying to help her. I was trying to help me. She was an embarrassment to me. She was a repeat of what my father had been to me, and what my husband had been to me, and now what my daughter was to me. And I bent over backwards trying to help her so that she would stop doing what she was doing, so that the people in Al-Anon and AA and our circle of friends and everything else wouldn't know that I had been such a terrible mother that she was driven to this. Now, does that make sense to you? That's the way I used to rationalize things, you know. And I can remember one time when I went down to bail her out. She never had to worry about anything. I did with her just like I did with her father. She didn't call me by a certain time on Saturday night. I'd call the sheriff's office and ask him if it would be necessary for me to have my attorney call them to find out where my daughter was. Same highfalutin ideas I'd had when Eddie was drinking, you know. And one time I went down to bail her out, and she stood right in the middle of the sheriff's office and folded her arms like this, and she said, I refuse to go unless you bail out my friends. And do you know I did? Because she was an embarrassment. I had not been sharing that at the meetings that I had been attending. I skirted it, but I never came right out and said how it was bothering me and what was going on. Wilma I shared with, but the rest of them I didn't. I still went back to playing the game in the program as well as when I was at home. And finally, I got to a meeting down on Laguna Beach, and I was about up to here with her and her antics, and for some reason or other, that day, to the meeting, a gal who is gone now, Theresa Green, but she came up to me, and she said, Winnie, I want to ask you one question. And I said, okay. She said, do you love your daughter, or are you determined to kill her with kindness? And it was the first time that I began to recognize what I was doing, not for her, but to her. Because you see, I was killing her by allowing her to use my defect of character, which was pride, to destroy her. When she ended up in jail, I tell you, I almost went nuts. Because I would go to the jail and I'd fill out that darn thing. You know, it was even worse than when Eddie went to jail. I'd fill out that slip, you know, saying I was a citizen of this country and I didn't have a police record and I wasn't carrying a gun and all this damn stuff that they should have known by just looking at me. But they made me fill it out. And then I would go inside and all this time I was saying to myself, what am I doing here? Why would she do this to me? Put me through this torment. And she'd come down from upstairs and we'd talk between this glass on a telephone and she'd cry on her side and I'd cry on my side. But always that one question, why? What am I doing here? And finally I was sitting there waiting for her and I had gotten to the place where I was almost enjoying going down there. You know, I got acquainted with some of the deputies and I did a lot of my Christmas shopping there that year because they make beautiful things in their ceramic, you know, things. Some of the best homes in West Covina have stuff that came from Sybil Brand, but they don't know it. I was just sitting there, and they have benches, and there was a bench here, and there was a bench behind me, and I heard this female behind me, and she was just blubbering like nobody's business. I mean, I had been quiet about it, but she was kind of noisy. And curiosity has always been one of my assets, and just for the heck of it, I turned around to look, and behind me sat an Al-Anon gal from a meeting in Whittier, California, and she took one look at me, and she said to me, "Winnie Eddie, what are you doing here?" As though it was just absolutely out of the question that I would be so stupid as to end up in Sybil Brand. But that was the day that I knew why I was there. And that was the day that I knew that regardless of what it is that happens in my life, the day that I'm afraid to share it with you, I'm cheating myself. Because I don't have a chance of getting over some of these things that can drive me up a wall unless I have the freedom to let you know how I feel. And to let you know that there are these things that do happen, no matter how hard you try to practice the principles of this program. That's what the principles are for. It's not to keep you from getting into the hole, it's to help you get out of the hole. And that was something that I had to come to terms with. It's kind of a funny aside, too, after Sally got out, and she was only in there, she was sentenced to be in there for a year. And I always kind of felt responsible because, see, I wouldn't go to court with her. I had always gone to court with her before, and she went to court by herself, and I wouldn't even send the lawyer, so she had to plead her own case, and she ended up in jail for a year, so I felt it was my fault. But then she got out in 3 months, and she decided she wanted to get a job. Now, she had never known how to do anything, but she learned to sew in jail. And so when she told me she was going to go over and take this job, and I said, "Sally, you're not going to get that job. I mean, you don't know how to do anything." She said, "Yes, I do, Mother. I learned to sew while I was in jail." And this was some kind of a job where you do piecework. You know what that is? I didn't really think it was the kind of a job she should have. That was the whole point of it. They'd have made her president, I'd have let her go. But despite me, she went over. And when she and her girlfriend came back, and I said, "Did you get the job?" And she said, "Well, they're going to call for an interview." And I said, "Did you fill out the application okay?" And she said, "I guess so." I said, "Well, what did you put down for experience?" And she said, "Sybil Brand." I said, "Oh, you mean to tell me that you told them your experience came from jail?" And she said, "Well, that's where I learned to sew." I said, "Well, forget it. You'll never get that job." And a few days later, they called and asked for an interview. And Sally went over. When she came back, she said, "I got the job." And I said, "You got the job?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "You must have lied to them." And she said, "No, I didn't lie to him." She said, "When he read over my application, he came to my experience, and it said Sybil Brand. And he said, 'Sybil Brand, I don't think I recognize that fashion house.'" And Sally said, "Well, it's the L.A. County." And he says, "Oh, well, if you work for the county, you can do this job." He didn't know that Sybil Brand was the woman's jail. And he thought it was another kind of a fashion house. And she got the job because she was honest. If she had followed my advice, she would have put down that she worked for Dior or some of those rather exclusive places, you see, because that delusion of grandeur was another one of the defects of character that I had to ask God to remove. I had to become who I am and stay there. And I'm having a hell of a time, you know, just being me. It just surprises people all the time that think I'm smart. And I let them think of it. I mean, I'm not responsible for what they think. But if they ask me, I tell them the truth. I'm not that smart. But it's just using the principles of this program. I mentioned earlier to somebody, and I don't remember who it was, it's very difficult for me to departmentalize this way of life. To me, it's one ball of wax. And it's difficult for me to take out except by remembering certain incidences that have happened over a period of time. what it's all about, you know, to go back and remember, because right now, usually, unless some big thing comes up, I almost do automatically what I have practiced to do one day at a time, over and over again. And the only thing I have to be sure of is that I keep it in segments that I can handle. Somebody asked me earlier today if there was a formula for Al-Anon that would help, you know, something that was very easy to remember that could keep you on the right track. And I asked them if they had ever read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said no. And I said, well, that's where you're going to find the answer. And she said, in the Big Book of AA? And I said, yes. Because at the end of chapter 5, it says we made clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. And I said, the only decision that you have to make after you get thoroughly acquainted with the ABC at the end of chapter 5 is, are you God? And if you're not, then you take your hands off. Because the power that runs my life today is a power greater than myself that I choose to call God. And that's pretty well sums up what the fourth, fifth, and sixth, seventh, too, are all about as far as I'm concerned. It makes it a lot easier, I guess, to look back than it does to look forward. My hindsight's always been a little bit better than my foresight. But we're getting to the part of the steps that I really had a lot of fun with. It didn't start out to be fun, but when I knew that I got to make a list of all persons I had harmed, there weren't very many, but I came up eventually with quite a long list, and then I got to make amends to them all. I was a very sarcastic person when I got to Al-Anon, and my first letter, amends letter that I made several copies of, I was just going to write the names in there. Well, you do things, you know. And it was so sarcastic that my sponsor burned them, because before you got to the end of the letter, it was your fault, you know, and I didn't realize it. But we'll get to that later on. For now, I think my watch, I've got on this damn watch I can't read, so it should be about 2 o'clock, right? Yeah. You're free.
This is the end of session 3, the start of session 4.
Okay. Any more announcements? I love announcements. As long as it isn't you are about to become the proud mother of. In Southern California, they usually have a gavel that's a meat tenderizer. And I've always thought it was so apropos, you know, they get this thing. Don't like gavels, but they love that meat tenderizer. Anyhow, I presume you're all having a good time.
Yeah.
Oh, I am. I'll tell you that for darn sure. I went over to my room after lunch today, or after the session today, to kind of commiserate with the seventh, or with the eighth and ninth step, because I still have trouble with that sometimes today, you know. Primarily because I think it's the way it's written. Made a list of all persons I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And I, as I have told you time and time again, I'm one of those people that quarrels with words. Harm to me meant hurt. And I couldn't honestly look back and see that I had hurt anybody. But my sponsor was of great help to me when she started pointing out that there were different ways of hurting people. I was thinking of physical hurt, because that was an easy out for me. You see, I never physically hurt anybody, so I could legitimately skip that step if it became necessary. But I didn't stop to think of the people that I had harmed, like my kids. Mine were not so much sins of commission as mine were sins of omission, or hurts of omission. When I would not do something that I could do to help somebody because of whatever fantasy or whatever reason that in my mind I didn't want to. It was a way of getting even with them without them knowing I was getting even with them, if you know what I mean. I think sometimes about my dad when he used to like to go with me someplace. He was always wanted to go with me, and I don't know why, you know, because I used to say to him, I don't want to take him. First thing you want to do is stop and get a drink, and I don't want to take him. And then he'd look sad enough long enough, and I'd take him. And I knew that he was one of those people that had to make frequent pit stops. I don't happen to have to do that for myself, because Eddie is responsible for me having probably one of the best set of kidneys in the world. I could never afford to go to the restroom, because if I did, he always got away from me. So I developed a method of being able to go for hours, like the, you know, like the camel. And one of the things that I thought about was the number of times that I took my father someplace when he was afraid to ask me to stop. And I knew he wanted me to stop, and I purposely wouldn't. Now, I don't know whether you understand what I'm trying to say, but these were the kind of things that I did that that made it necessary for me to become willing to make amends for the things that I had done. I also had to go back over and realize that there were a lot of things that I had done as far as my husband was concerned, things that that I really could have done a little bit differently and probably done a little bit better and made his life a little easier, that I didn't do for the very same reason that I used to torment my father in my own way. And that was because it was my way of getting even with him for what I thought he had done to me. All of these things are the things that that Wilma brought out to me what meant harming some other individual. And so I ended up with quite a long list of people I had harmed, and I was willing to make amends to them all. And as I kind of told you before at the last session, I fixed up a sort of a form letter that said I was sorry, but I didn't say what for. And I didn't say I wasn't going to do it again, and I didn't say anything that might have, you know. But I was willing to let him know that I was aware of the fact that I had done things that I shouldn't have done. And Wilma took one look at that letter, and she said, that'll never do. And I said, why not? And she said, because you're still playing a game with your own life. Until you can honestly, willingly go to these individuals, or be willing to go to these individuals and tell them exactly what it is and ask them to forgive you, you're not going to have any peace of mind. They probably have long since forgotten and maybe don't even know that you did any of these things. And when you go to make amends, you go not for their sake, but for your sake, to get them off your back and to make a clear path so that you can walk through life without always looking over your shoulder and wondering, when will they realize that this is what I did? You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about one time when I was playing in a golf tournament, and the girl in the threesome behind me got a hole in one, and they wheeled in a bottle of champagne. It was about, well, it gets bigger every time I tell. It was about that big. Sort of like a fish story from the city. But anyhow, I helped her drink it because I didn't want her to get in trouble. And then I got in my car, and I drove 40 miles on those L.A. freeways back to my house, turned in my driveway, missed the driveway completely, and went through the fence. And that sobered me up just like that. You know, I thought, oh, my God, Eddie is going to kill me. Well, no, he wasn't going to kill me. I knew that. But I did know that he was going to find out that I was capable of doing what he had done several times, and that is go through the fence and wreck the front end of the car. So I called a fella in AA that I knew that fixed fences, and I asked him to come over right away and fix the fence, and he did. And then I took the car down to where we usually got it fixed, and I said to the fella, how long is it going to take you to fix this car? And he said, oh, about 3 days. And I said, no, I have to have it done before Eddie gets home tonight. And so he straightened it out, and he painted it, and he said, for God's sakes, don't let him lean on it because it's still wet. And I went home, and to all intents and purposes, I should have been completely at ease. I had redone everything that I had loused up. And to all intents and purposes, Eddie might never have found out that I had done it, except I began to wait to see whether maybe one of the neighbors would say to him, Winnie sure came through that driveway, didn't she? Or one of the kids say, did you know Mother had to take the car down to have it fixed? And so, as I usually did when I was trapped, I called my sponsor. And she said to me, well, I think you better tell him. And I said, tell him? I just got through doing all this stuff so that he wouldn't find out. And she said, well, you can do what you want to. But if you don't tell him, you're going to spend the rest of your life waiting for him to find out. And that's what's going to make you uncomfortable. Not the fact that you went through the fence, not the fact that you wrecked the front end of the car, but the fact that you are giving somebody else a power over your life that you can't control. And that kind of reminded me of the time that when I first came into Al-Anon and they said, be good to yourself. Did they ever tell you that? Well, when you say be good to yourself, to me, that meant go shopping. And I did. And I bought this dress one day. It was on sale. And I can't pass up a sale. If it says sale, I buy it. I used to. I don't anymore. But I'd buy it even if it didn't fit me. You know, I just was a compulsive shopper, I guess you might call me. So anyhow, I bought this dress, and I paid a lot of money for it, even though it was on sale. But I thought it would kind of really, you know, stand out. But on the way home, the dress was sitting beside me, and I began to think, I shouldn't have paid that much for that dress. And so I talked to myself on the way home, and I explained to me that I had just asked Eddie how much he thought I paid for it. And when he got to within what I thought was a reasonable price, I'd say, you do it every time. And that's what I did. I just let him guess until he got close to what it was, and I figured he'll give me that much, and out of the household money in my own account, I'll be able to get the difference, and I can pay for the dress, and then he'll never have to know that I've been a sucker again. So it didn't work out that way. I got his money all right, but I had to buy shoes, and I had to buy a purse, and I had to buy several other things to go with this damn dress. And the first bill came in, and I almost fainted when I saw and realized what I had paid for that dress. And so I put that away and figured I'd save it, the money, that is. And this went on for 3 months. I finally got a bill that was stamped, you'd better or we're gonna. And I knew I was in trouble, so I called Wilma, and I told her what was going on. And she said to me, just like she had about the car, she said, well, I guess you're going to have to tell him. I said, tell him? I can't tell him. For 3 months, I've been lying to him. How can I tell him? She said, do what you want to do. If you can figure another way, it's all right with me. But if I were you, I'd tell him. So I got the kids fed and in bed, and I fixed a nice dinner for Eddie, and soft lights and candles, the whole bit, you know, just like I used to entice him when he was drinking. And he knew there was something wrong, you know, because my change of attitude. And when I thought he was in a mellow mood, I said to him, Eddie, you know that dress I bought? Now, by now I hate the dress. I wouldn't wear it if they gave it to me. Because every time I put it on, it reminds me once more of all this mess that I've gotten myself into. And I said to him, you remember that dress I bought? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I didn't exactly tell you the truth about it. He said, yes, I know. And I said, what do you mean you know? Have you been going through my dresser drawers? Because that's what I used to do to him. I'd go through his pockets, through his wallet, and through his dresser drawers to see if there was any contraband. And so naturally, I figured he must do the same to me, you know. And he said, Winnie, I didn't go through your dresser drawers. Why are you so upset? And I said, because how could you know I didn't tell you the truth if you didn't go through my dresser drawers? And he said, you know those things that hang on the sleeve when you buy something? And I said, yes. And he said, you forgot to take them off. And he had known for 3 months that I had lied to him about that doggone dress. Well, that made me mad. Because I thought the least he could have done, I always told him when he was lying, and I thought the least he could have done was reciprocate by being nice and telling me that I was lying. And instead, I called my sponsor and I told her. how terrible he had been to me, and how I had done all this stuff to make it nice so I could tell him about this, and he had to ruin the whole evening just by telling me that he knew I was lying. And she said to me, "Well, I hope you learned a lesson from this." And I said, "Well, I did." And she said, "What is it?" And I said, "I'll never leave the store again till they take those damn things off." But these were some of the things that I did that were on my amends list. Now, maybe I was all wrong about putting those on there, but I had to make amends to myself before I made amends to anybody else, because I couldn't have done to you the things that I had done to myself. But I, when I got to the ninth step, making direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others, that's a toughie. That's one of those where the person that you have hurt the most, you care the most about, and usually is the closest to you. And it makes it awfully difficult to go to somebody and make amends, like to my husband or to my children or to somebody else. And I was at a retreat just like this when I heard the retreat master say, to make an amends to a contract means to change that contract. And if you can, in your innermost self, admit to God, just yourself and to another human being, that you will never again do this thing which has caused harm to another human being, you have made an amends. Because this whole program, this whole way of life, to me today, is based on a change in attitude. And an attitude, I believe, is what the seventh and the eighth and the ninth step are all about. To change what I used to be like to what I can be like today on a daily basis if I practice the principles of this fellowship and this program. I didn't know what a change of attitude really was, to tell you the truth. I know that it sounds like there were a lot of things I didn't know, and there were a lot of things I didn't know. But those things that I didn't know were the things that I spent my life dodging. I knew what they were, I just didn't accept them, that was all. But I went to a meeting one time when I was new, and I had found something out. I don't remember even what it was, but it was some great big deal that I was going to lay on them so they could get better. And I was late as usual, and when I got in there, everybody was already seated around the table, and the gal that was leading the meeting was one of those, you know, that she always knew what she was doing, and she had her meeting all planned, and so I knew I wasn't going to be able to bring up what would help them the most, which was what I had to tell them. I had a seat way in the back, and hell, she wouldn't have called on me if she'd, you know, because she didn't like me, I knew that. And the topic she had chosen that night was the difference between love and hate. Now, when I sat down in that chair, I knew the difference between love and hate, because I hated the leader, I hated my seat, I hated the topic, I hated the people that were there at the meeting. I was filled with hate. And yet, as they started around that table talking about what the difference between love and hate meant to each and every one of them, when it got to me, I didn't have anything to say. And I think the reason is because that I suddenly realized that the leader hadn't changed, my seat hadn't changed, the topic hadn't changed, but my attitude towards it had changed. And I began to look back and see how many things that I loved one minute and hated the next. And the things never changed. The only thing that ever changed was my attitude towards it. And that is what I try to work on, and that is what I think I discovered doing the eighth and the ninth steps, making the amends and noticing that my attitude towards something is what creates the necessity to make the amends. Because actually, if it hadn't been for the fact that I was unable to see myself as I really was, created that attitude, made it unnecessary, or made it necessary for me to play these various and sundry parts that I had played until I had built up such a list of people that in reality I had harmed in one way or another, that being willing to make the amends, which they told me was the most important part of that step, they said being willing is 9/10 of being able to do it. Willingness is the key to change, and willingness I had. I always put the 10th step in with the 8th and 9th because, to me, continuing to take a personal inventory and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it, has made it possible for me to eliminate the necessity of making as many amends as I had to make before. Because I know what other people will never know about me. I know when I'm wrong. And being able to promptly admit it, that's the one thing that I like in the AA 12 and 12, is the fact that it says, now is when you admit you're wrong. You don't wait until next week, next month, or until you take the eighth or ninth step again. If you're wrong, promptly admit it, and it eliminates the necessity of trying to stay on an even keel as far as my life is concerned. And you know, it's kind of fun to call somebody on the phone that you've done something to or done something about or whatever, where you are wrong and have to admit it. And here, the strange attitude that they have. They don't have people do this, you know. An AA fellow that I heard one time said that he had given quite a good deal of thought to his first wife. He'd been married about 7 times. And they used to have a sticker that said, if you've been married to Jack, honk. And and he had gotten to thinking about his first wife, who had divorced him because of his drinking. And he got real honest and sort of melancholy about it one day, and he realized, well, she was the mother of his children, and she had done his washing, and she had done his cooking, and she had done all of these things that a wife is supposed to do, and he hadn't treated her very badly, so possibly he did owe her an amends. And so he called her on the phone and asked her if he could come by and see her, and she said yes, and he went over, and he made his amends to her. And he said, if I'd have known it was going to shake her up as much as it did, I would have done it 10 years sooner, you know. Because it does shake people up to have you admit that you're wrong and to be able to go on from there, because then nobody has any kind of power over you. You are your own conscious contact with a God of your understanding. And I don't consider the 10th step to be similar to the 4th step. Now, that's just my way. I say that because sometimes people think if you're standing up here, you know more than somebody else, and I don't. But for myself, the 10th step is something that I do on a daily basis. And making amends is something I do on a daily basis because it eliminates the necessity for me to have to live with some of the uncomfortable feelings that I lived with before if I take care of it now. And it has worked for me. I like the idea of, I've been talking so much between that I don't know what I've said and what I haven't said, you know. But anyhow, if this is a repeat, that's all right. Take 5 cents off of there. But I went to Wilma one day and I said to her, I think Eddie's going to get drunk. And she said, how do you know? And I said, because he isn't working the program. And she said, how do you know he isn't working the program? And I said, because he's supposed to make amends, and he hasn't made any. And she said, how do you know he hasn't made any amends? And I said, because I've been available, and he hasn't said anything. And she got up from where she was sitting and walked over to her desk and picked up 2 pencils and 2 pieces of paper. And she came back over, and she put one of them in front of me and sat down with the other one. And she said, you know, now that you mention it, Russell has never made any amends to me either. So as long as you're here, why don't you and I make a list of the amends that we should make to them so that when they make their amends to us, we'll be ready. And I couldn't pick up the pencil because my mind began to go over some of the things I had done to him, you know, and hiding his car, switching his drawers, putting Epicac in his beer. Yeah, I ran out of drugstores before he ran out of brands. You know, he'd get sick and he'd say, I think I got a green beer. Because my husband was strictly a beer drinker. He'd drink anything, but beer was his drink of choice. Had me convinced at one time that it was a non-alcoholic beverage because he said they feed it to babies, and they do. I looked it up in the medical books. They use it. on real little babies as anesthesia. However, not in the quantities he was drinking. That was the difference. But anyhow, I couldn't pick up that pen. I couldn't write down any of those things. And she said to me, "Why can't you write it down?" I said, "Because if he finds out what I've really done to him, he'll divorce me." And she said, "Well, didn't it ever occur to you that he might have the same problem?" And it never occurred to me. Because you see, I was using the principles of this program to try to find out if he had really done all the things that I thought he had done. And I think that was the beginning of my being able to let go of the past, the drinking past. I don't want to know what he did, because I'm not sure that I have the stamina or the internal fortitude to forgive him for the things, or to forget the things. And by the same token, I don't want him to know what I did either. I don't want to have to go to him and tell him some of the things that I did to him. And so I like the idea of making the amends by changing, by being able to take that 10th step, take that 9th step, and take that 8th step and work them all together. And that's the way I do it. And it works for me. And that's pretty much the way I guess Wilma worked it too. She's one of those people that I wish she'd have come up here with me, because on account of, I like sometimes to have her speak for herself, you know. I told her, I said, "Most of the people that listen to me think you're Confucius." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Because just about every other word out of my mouth is Wilma says." And she said, but I didn't do any big deal or any big thing as far as you're concerned. And you know, when her husband was sick and passed away, she withdrew. She just changed completely, you know. She wouldn't go to meetings, she wouldn't let anybody in, she wouldn't have anything to do with anybody. And Kitty Archer called me on the phone and she said, "Winnie, why don't you call Wilma? Because if you call her, she'll figure you're in trouble, and if you're in trouble, she may let you in." See, because I have her kind of conditioned. And I said, "Okay, I'll give her a call and see what happens." And I called her and she said I could come over, so I went over. And I sat down with her and I started to pitch at her some of the things that she had pitched at me over the years. And all of a sudden the tears started to roll down her cheeks. And she said to me, "I used to wonder where I got the things that I said to you. And now I know that God gave them to me to give to you so that you could take care of them until I needed them." That to me is what this fellowship is all about. That to me is the reason that anybody who tries to use the 12 steps of AA that they have given us permission to use has to improve, has to have a better way of life. Because everything that was wrong with me is covered in those 12 steps. And I can only say it on a one-to-one basis, because it's me that loused up my life. That takes me right back to the first step. Takes me right through the second step. Takes me right to the third step. The 11th step made a decision. Wait a minute, I'm all confused here. It's the fresh air. Thought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him, praying only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. Now that isn't exactly the way that it is in the book, but that's the way I have to work it. Because when my mother was ill, God sent me an AA gal that I learned to hate in 3 days, and that is a record. I was staying at the hospital and she stayed at the hospital, and every so often she'd look at me and she'd say, "Take the third step." And I'd say, "I have." And a little while later she'd say, "Winnie, please take the third step." And I'd say, "I have taken the third step." Well, after about 2 days of that, she said it once too often, and I flipped on her just like I have flipped on people all my life. And I said to her, "Gloria, your problem is that you keep touting me off on the third step and I'm really on the 11th. And so I repeated them both just in case she didn't know. And she was in AA long before I ever got to Al-Anon. made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out. And do you know that all these years that I've heard people talk about release, I never released anything in my life. And as I told you last night, or maybe this morning, or whenever it was, when Wilma gave me the job of typing up that thing, I didn't even know how to spell it. And yet, when I repeated those two steps to Gloria, I heard the formula for release. Because you see, I was always willing to turn my life over to the care of God. I just wouldn't turn your life over to the care of God. And when I put those two steps together, it finally brought home the idea that when I ask for help, that help has to be for me, not for you. I can ask God to help you, but he has to help you on a direct basis. He can't do it through me, because that's not the way he works. At least he doesn't work that way in my life. When my daughter was sick, I've had so many manifestations of this one thing that, and yet I keep going back to it every so often. But when Sally was having all her troubles, I made novenas like they were going out of style. I lit so many candles, the fire insurance went up on the church. You know, and the priest thought I was having some kind of a renewal or something, because I was always in church praying, asking, what can I do? Tell me what to do. And sitting in at the table one day, I said to Eddie, I just don't understand why it isn't working. Look at what I've done. Look at the prayers I've said. Look at the candles I've lit. Look at the things I've done, and I still don't have an answer. And he said to me, the reason you don't have an answer is because you haven't got the problem. And that's true. It's also true that my sponsor used to say to me, the reason you haven't got the problem is because you, or the answer is because you haven't got the problem. See, I worry ahead. I don't wait until it happens. I try to be prepared so that if it happens, I can take care of it right away, you know. And she used to say to me, if God sent you a special delivery letter and told you to stay home on Thursday, he had a miracle coming your way, you'd call him on the phone and ask him to make it Friday because you got something to do on Thursday. See? Because that's the way I am. Those are the things I have to guard against in my own life. Now, I don't know what step that covers. Probably it covers them all. But it was all of these steps up to and including the 12th that made me aware of what was going on, made me aware of the fact that my problems never came from out there. My problems came from the inside. And my solutions also came from the inside. I like that idea that happiness is an inside job, because many times it isn't what you say to me that bothers me. It's what I think of when you say it. That was something else that we were talking about here a little bit earlier. My husband is one of them cheerful individuals. He's got faith coming out of his ears, you know, and he just seems to go along and nothing bothers him. I do all the worrying. That's why my hair is this color. He doesn't have a gray hair in his head. He says it's hereditary, but I think it's because he was preserved in alcohol for so long. But once in a while, I would declare a let's be good to Winnie Day. Have you ever done that? When you just say, oh, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to do the dishes. I'm, you know, nothing. And I'll read, especially if it's raining. I love to read when it rains. And I curl up and I enjoy the whole day until about 4:45. And then it suddenly dawns on me, he's going to be home in 15 minutes. And I haven't done a thing. So I get up and I rush around and I try to get everything done in 15 minutes that other people have been doing all day. And I'm worn out in 15 minutes. And he walks in with that cheerful attitude and says, what have you been doing all day? And I want to kill him. It isn't what he says to me, it's what I think of when he says it. And that's part of what I have to guard against also, is the fact that I don't let what you say trigger something inside that I haven't taken care of that's going to louse up my life. Because this is a save yourself program. They told me that. They didn't say it exactly that way, but this is on. Now, see, part of my success in Al-Anon, I believe, came from the fact that I believed everything I heard them say in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of those people that couldn't understand the Al-Anon. They were too nice for me. They were, you know. They were all loving. I was all hating. But I could go over there and I could hear these, because I don't know how it was when you came in, and I'm not downing Al-Anon. Don't get me wrong. I owe my life to those people. But I couldn't be that nice. And I knew I couldn't be that nice. But I could go over there and listen to them argue and fight and still be friends. They couldn't do that in Al-Anon. If you had a fight in Al-Anon, there were sides. These were against those. Now, maybe it isn't that way in Oregon, but it was that way in California. And I was always right in the middle. You know, I spent my life being in the middle. And I don't like being in the middle. See, I used to... Eddie would tell me something about something the kids were doing that he didn't like, and I'd say, I'll tell him about it. And then in my own way, I would say, so-and-so upset your father, so please, don't do it when he's going to know anything about it. That gave them the freedom to go ahead and do it, and it also gave them a hint that they better not let him find out. And then they would say, I got a ticket, Mom, and I'd say, for God's sakes, don't let your father find out. I'll tell him. And then I'd say to him, you know how they are with these kids coming from school. They just give them tickets right and left, whether they do anything or not. And Eddie would agree with me. And then we'd take care of the ticket. Always in the middle. I forgot they were related. And one day I got mad at both of them and stepped out of the middle, and they've been friends ever since, you know. And it was the same way when I first came to Al-Anon. I was always in the middle. And it just, because, see, I didn't know enough about whether you were right or you were right. And so I tried to walk that real narrow line. But in AA, that's where I found out that you can disagree agreeably without letting it become so big and so bad that you can't get over it. One of the greatest lessons I learned when I was new in Al-Anon was the fact that not everybody had to work as hard as I did to get this program. Because you see, I thought everybody that was there had to work as hard as I did in order to feel a little bit better and get a little bit better. But it's not that way. And the very first time that I heard somebody who I thought a great deal of say something that I knew was absolutely, positively wrong, I almost dropped dead. I thought, she's not working the program. And I called Wilma on the phone and I told her. I said, you know, that was an out-and-out lie. And Wilma said, well, what difference does it make? And I said, but she's been around so long, she should know better. And Wilma says, well, you've been around for a while too, and you don't know any better. And I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, I mean that you are as guilty of judging her as she is of whatever she did. And two wrongs never made a right. And from that time on, it was all right with me, no matter what you said or what you did. If that's what you thought, and that's how you felt, and that's what you wanted to do, it was okay. And it works out great. It also eliminates an awful lot of amends. And that's, I think, is that right? I can't go by this damn watch. Oh, I got 10 minutes more? Well, I'll tell you, I'm working the steps faster now than I ever did before. Anybody got any questions? I saw the cook come over and I thought he was waiting for us. I think he, oh yes, I'm sorry.
How do your kids feel as a family? That is, how they relate to one another? What kinds of...
They're very close. Very close. In fact, it almost scares you to see how close they are, you know. They fight. Don't misunderstand me. They have disagreements. I won't say they fight, but they have disagreements. But from the time they were able to get out and around, it was well known as at school and any place else that they were, that if you pick on one, you better be able to lick the other seven. And they still have that closeness even today. You know, they get together for barbecues, they go places together, they buy things together, they do everything together. And I think part of it is because there's so many of them, you know. There's a whole group and they can buy almost anything they want to if they put their minds to it. Yeah.
I don't understand what a codependent is. and how that's different from being an Al-Anon.
Well, you and I are in the same boat. See, that's something I'm not. I'm not a codependent. I had somebody that, I don't think it was codependent that she called me. Every so often I go down and talk at the Naval Hospital in Long Beach, and I know it's because I'm a classic example of what the Navy hopes never turns up in their ranks again. But I go because I have amends to make. And the gal that usually asked me to come down there, when I got, she called me a co-alcoholic. She didn't call me a codependent. She called me a co-alcoholic. Betty L. was busy, and so she had told this little corpsman to watch for me. And I got off the elevator, and I was just standing there. I didn't see Betty and all these sailors and so forth and walking around. And this little corpsman circled me a couple of times before she came up, and she said to me, "Are you the co-alcoholic?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And so she kind of backed off and circled me a couple of more times. And then she came up and she said, "What are you?" And I said to her, "I'm Winnie Eddy." I said, "I can tell you who I am, but I can't tell you what I am." And when I said, "I'm Winnie Eddy," she said, "Well, you're the co-alcoholic." And I said, "No, I'm not." So when I started to talk at that meeting, she was sitting right on the front row, and I felt kind of sorry for her, you know, because I had kind of thrown her for a loop, and that's making amends. There's your 10th step. I wanted to make amends to her. So I said, when I came to Al-Anon, I was a Siamese twin. And those females performed one of the most delicate, painful operations I have ever experienced when they separated me from him. And co-alcoholic to me makes me responsible for what he did in my mind. And so I'm not a co-anything. I don't know where they came up with that. I will tell you that one of the reasons that they have some of these scientific, medical type designations for us now is because if you are a codependent or you are a co-alcoholic or you are a, there's another one, CODA. What is CODA?
Codependence.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, if you are one of those, you're covered by insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and that is exactly where it came from. You can't, they won't turn you in if you're nuts, but they will if you're a co-alcoholic. See? And it always kind of saddens me to see people have to pay for what I was given free of charge for nothing. But in some instances, I guess it's necessary, you know. And if it is necessary, then that's important. I don't knock anything that helps anybody. I don't care what it is, because from the very beginning, when they first started talking about conference-approved literature, and I'll tell you very frankly, I was not all for conference-approved literature because I thought it put a kind of a fence around your recovery by limiting you to what you could use and what would help you. And I remember at one of the intergroup meetings saying, if I walk in to a 12-step call and I hand a girl the face on the barroom floor and I say to her, "This is what helped me," if she believes me, it will help her too. Because it isn't what you read that helps. It wasn't what I read that helped me, it's what I shared that helped me. You see, all the reading in the world is not going to come up with an answer, at least for me. Because I've read just about anything and everything that I can get my hands on. The ODAP book always tickled me, you know, especially when they put the appendix out. Because I was at a meeting one day, and the format of the meeting was that they had these little pieces of paper with, like they'd have love, and they'd have let go and let God, and it was on a piece of paper, and they had a number down there, and then after it was passed around, then the leader called off a number, and the person who had that number took that saying and talked about it. And I was sitting next to this little gal, and I don't know how long she'd been around, but I took my piece of paper, and she took hers, and she opened it, and she looked at it, and she stuffed it in her pocket, and she reached for the ODAP book. And I thought, I wonder what she got. You know, I mean, well, I didn't know, and I was curious, so I said to her, "What did you get?" And she took the little piece of paper out and handed it to me, and on it, it said, "Love." And I said to her, "You're not going to find love in that book." That book helps explain to me what this feeling is that I can't put a title to. It's love. But I can't learn to love by just reading that book. I don't care how many different pages cover love. None of them are ever going to cover that feeling. Because if you don't have the feeling, you don't know what you're talking about. This isn't, to me, it isn't a way of life that has to do with words. It has to do with feeling. And that's why it works the way it does. But that's just the way it works for me. It doesn't necessarily mean that it makes anything wrong for anybody else. That's one of the things that I think you have to come to terms with when you come to the fellowship of AA or Al-Anon. And that is that you have to have the courage to reach out and find out what you're all about, and the faith and the trust to allow it to happen. Whatever comes along, I don't know what it is, but I do know that by allowing myself to go with the flow, just like that river, to let it happen and let it go, if I stay the heck out of the way, it works. And I don't know how it works. And as I've said many, many, many times, and it was the gospel truth every time I said it, if I ever find out how it works, I'll probably change it. Yeah.
By the time you and your husband come to the program, your older children might have been fairly old. I don't know. How did they respond to the change in your life that you worked the program together?
Well, I can tell you how they responded to me. They recognized almost immediately that when Wilma was around, I was different. And in the beginning, it was sort of like a game, you know. She came, I would have to impress her with how well I was working the program, which was a damn lie, you know. I used to work at an hour and a half at the meetings and come home and raise Cain, and if she came over, I could go from being a devil to an angel that fast, you know. But the kids recognized a change in me when she was around. And they responded to that change in me. You know, I forget who it was I was talking to, but when my kids were small, you see, I always thought of my kids as being an extension of me. They were sort of like the publicity of how good a mother I was. So I used to try to make them do the right things at the right time in the proper way and so forth. I used to say to them, if I would get them ready to go to a birthday party or something, you know, where they were going to be out with other people and so forth, my parting shot was always, remember who you are. And one day my oldest son, who was about 11 at the time that I came to Al-Anon, well, it couldn't, yeah, 11, about that. And one day when I gave that little line to him, he turned around and looked me right in the eye and he says, you know, Mom, sometimes you don't even know who you are. You see? But they recognized that in me. They more or less were smarter than I was all during that time. Because they did not allow me to disturb them to the point that I feel that they were harmed forever. You know, they still laugh about some of the things, which embarrasses me a lot of times, because it's usually at Thanksgiving or something, you know, and they'll say, God, you should have seen Mom before she came to Al-Anon, and then they start, you know. And they can remember a lot more about me before I came to Al-Anon than I can remember about me. But it's okay, you see, because we are a family who learned to laugh together about the things we used to cry about alone. And I think that's part of the healing, you know. I've always felt that Al-Anon was put into existence for my benefit, because I came into Al-Anon in October of 1957. And Al-Anon became Al-Anon in December of 1957. So I had two kids that were in the original group, you know. In fact, they drafted them because they wanted to have a few people. And so they asked me, please, to let them go. And they just loved it, you know. And I think that helped them, too. But I don't believe that the scars that possibly they had from my upbringing were so deep that they couldn't. You know, I think they had a natural resiliency to me, or for some reason or other. One thing I did have to do after I got to Al-Anon was quit laying out their clothes. You know how early you have to get up in the morning to lay out clothes for 8 kids? And Wilma told me I had to stop that. But I used to have them color coordinated. You know, the shirts, the pants, the socks, everything had to be right. Eddie, too. I used to lay his clothes out. He's not colorblind, but he's got a thing about stripes and plaids that just drive me up a wall. He wears them together, you know, and it used to be embarrassing for me to go places with him when he looked like a circus clown. At least that's what I used to call him. And so Wilma said to me one day, you're going to have to quit dressing those kids. They're getting to an age. Well, Butch was at least 11, and he was the oldest. And she said, you're going to have to let them alone because you're making cripples out of them. They're never going to be able to dress themselves if you don't knock this off. And I said, well, I'll quit picking their clothes out, but do I have to quit picking Eddie's clothes out? And she said, yes, you do. And I said, well, what about the stripes and the plaids? And she said, he's got them on. If you let it embarrass you, that's your problem, not his. So one day my youngest son, George, came home from school, and this was quite a while after I quit helping him, and he was madder than a wet hen. He said, I had on two different socks today. And I said, well, I'm sorry, George, but I guess you're just going to have to get up earlier and get them matched up if that's what happened and you're embarrassed by it. And that was about all that was said. And a few weeks, months, or time is relevant. I don't know how long after that. But we were sitting at the table after dinner discussing things, and I was trying to explain something to my son Donald, who's one of the twins. And I used George as an example. I said, it's just like George wearing two different socks to school. I said, George, you don't wear two different socks to school, do you? He says, not unless I wear my boots. Now, he learned that himself. I never would have thought of putting boots on him just because he had on two different socks. You see? So I think that kids grow in spite of you, not because of you. And that's God's will. You know, God protects fools and children. Both of us. Okay. Okay. Let's eat.
This is the end of session 4, the start of session 5.
Morning, because you know I go through this. Well, it is Sunday. I should really be a little more sedate. For me, that's a slip. You know, when I begin to think I should be something, I usually get into trouble. But God always sends me an Eskimo, and this morning He sent Raven over, and she looked at this and she said, "Oh, is that a top?" And I said, "Yes." I was going to wear it, but I, you know, thought it was a little risque. She said, "Well, wear it. They'll love it." And I thank God I'm still able to take direction, you know. That shows that you never get well enough to make your own decisions, because usually they aren't too great. Well, we're now at the 12th step, which is one of my favorites. And I don't think Raven noticed, but the sweatshirt that I had on was step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And they gave me that, one of those, a long, long time ago, and it was embroidered. And it was embroidered for me because I could never remember the darn thing. You know, there was sort of a mental block there. As I told you the other night or the other day or whenever, I was one of those people that came in, got an inkling of what was going on, and went right into 12-step work. Because it just, well, for one thing, it kept me from having to do the rest of them damn steps. And I was meeting a lot of people that were in worse shape than I was. That always helps, too. You know, if you can find, I think it's in the 20 questions where they ask you, do you seek lower companions? And I always did, see. I wanted to find people that were in worse shape than I was so that I would find an excuse for not doing some of the things that Wilma told me I had to do. Now, figure that one out. You can give somebody an answer in November. But anyhow, I would make a 12-step call any time of the day or night, you know. And this one particular day, I was having my own squirrel cage. I don't even know what it was that was bothering me. But the telephone rang, and it was central office, and she had a call that was in my area, and she wanted to know would I accept the call. And I said, why, certainly, of course. I had my own storage bin of literature, you know. And I could go at any time. And so she gave me the address. And when I hung up the phone, the strangest thing happened to me, the same thing that had happened to me many, many times before, but I had not been aware of it. There was a transition from the squirrel cage I had stepped in to being sort of like an evangelist. I was about to carry the message. And I got in my car and I drove over to this girl's house. And when she opened the door, it was almost like stepping into my past. She had her hair halfway tied up in a bandana. And she had two little kids kind of half hiding behind her. And she wasn't sure when she opened the door whether she was going to let me in or not. And but she did, and she took me into the living room, and her mother was sitting there. And it looked like we were going to a wake. I mean, you know, we were all so solemn and so serious, but I was being divine. And and we started to talk, and her mother kept saying, don't forget to tell her this, don't forget to tell her this. And all of a sudden, the girl whipped around at her, and she said, Mother, please, how do I know what I'm going to say until I've heard what I've said? And I understood that, which was kind of strange, you know, right away, because a lot of other things I didn't understand that I'd heard. But I stayed for about an hour, and I didn't share my experience, strength, and hope with her. What I shared with her was what I had heard other people say at meetings, which was their experience, strength, and hope. And when I walked out the door, she put her arms around me and gave me a hug and thanked me for coming, and she said to me, I feel so much better. Thank you for coming. I walked out, got in the car, closed the door, and I was back in my own squirrel cage again. The transition had been complete. I had gone back. And I started the car, headed for home, and all of a sudden I heard what she said. Thank you for coming. I feel so much better. And I was immediately mad at her. Why should she feel better? I'm the one that carried the message. And I don't feel any better. And I don't know, have you ever sort of had a thought go through your head like there was somebody whispering in your ear? And all of a sudden I heard this voice or whatever say, she believed you, but you don't.